Lecture 29. War resumes. The Athenian disaster in Sicily.
Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. At the end of our last lecture, we asked the question how long the Peace of Nicias, which ended the Archidamian War, would last. The answer is not long. In this lecture, we're going to touch on the renewal of hostilities in the Peloponnesian War, and then we're going to turn to a new theatre of war far away from the Greek mainland, and that's Sicily. This geographical shift should, and indeed does, strike us as surprising. And in focusing on the Athenian-Sicilian expedition, we'll discuss how it came about, what happened during it, and how it affected the Athenian war effort. The Peace of Nicias was really only an interruption in the whole sequence of events of the Peloponnesian War. That's why we agree with Thucydides that we're not dealing with two separate wars, Peloponnesian War Minor, Peloponnesian War Major, but that we're dealing with just the one that was interrupted by a couple of years of a hiatus in hostilities. It was an ominous sign that some Peloponnesian states were unhappy with the terms of the Peace of Nicias, and that Corinth, Megara, and Boeotia didn't sign it. Moreover, Sparta didn't return Amphipolis to Athens, nor did Athens return Pylos to Sparta, both of which each side was supposed to do under the terms of the peace. In Athens, a war faction grew to dominance led by Alcibiades. And it was this war faction that countered Nicias' passive group. Alcibiades is one of the more colourful characters in the Peloponnesian War, indeed in the 5th century. He was an aristocrat. He had a family connection to Pericles even. He was tremendously wealthy. At one time, he entered multiple teams in the Olympic chariot race event, and you had to be fabulously wealthy to do that sort of thing. He was also quite young, and he lived an ostentatious party lifestyle. He'd be a lot like the Hollywood teens and those in their 20s that we hear about all the time in the media. Too much money, far too little brains, and no responsibility. Alcibiades was a strategos in 420, and you'd think that because of his aristocratic background, that Thucydides would give him a good press. But the reverse is the case. As I mentioned in a previous lecture, Alcibiades was eager to win military glory for himself. Although an aristocrat, Thucydides sees him as no different from the other demagogues, because Alcibiades was pursuing a policy that was in his own best interests, not the well-being of Athens. In Alcibiades' case, as I said, he was after military glory. And this was clearly something he could never achieve while Athens wasn't at war with someone. Obviously, Alcibiades and Nicias were headed for a showdown at some stage. And we might even expect one of them to have been ostracized. We remember how Cimon had got rid of his rival Themistocles, for example. But while there was an ostracism in 418, for some reason, neither of these men, that's neither Alcibiades or Nicias, was ostracized. Instead, that honour, to call it that, fell on a rising demagogue called Hyperbolus, who was by trade a lamp maker. Perhaps the groups attached to Alcibiades and Nicias couldn't get enough ostraca with the other person's name on them, prepared in time. Perhaps the people simply couldn't choose between the two. Both Alcibiades and Nicias continued to advise the assembly, and it was the oratory of Alcibiades that was winning out. Incidentally, the ostracism of Hyperbolus in 418 was the last time that the Athenians held an ostracism. Now, in that year, in 418, thanks to the activities of the dissatisfied Peloponnesian allies, not to mention Argos, and these sorts of events don't really concern us here, Alcibiades was able to persuade the Athenians that Sparta had broken the peace of Nicias. So in 418, hostilities proper resume again. Now, over the next few years, both sides, Athens and Sparta, lost and gained ground. But then in 416, a sequence of events began that would result in the war taking a dramatic turn for the worst for the Athenians. And that's because they became embroiled in Sicily. And I want to deal with Sicily and the so-called Sicilian expedition in some detail now. In the winter of 416, an embassy from the town of Egesta on the island of Sicily went to Athens. And it went to Athens to request assistance in a conflict it was having with its southern neighbour, Salinas. Now, Salinas was an ally of Syracuse. We've met Syracuse before. This was a colony of Athens's enemy, Corinth. And Syracuse was also the largest and the most powerful polis on Sicily. So that meant if the Athenians agreed to support Egesta against Salinas, they'd also be taking on Syracuse, because Syracuse would naturally help out its ally Salinas against them. Now, this was the opportunity that Alcibiades was waiting for. What's more, the Egestans sweetened the request by offering to pay for the entire cost of the Athenian expedition. So the assembly voted that a reconnaissance mission should be sent to Egesta to see whether this Athenian expedition was worthwhile. In other words, to find out whether the Egestans could really afford to pay for it. This Athenian mission was apparently very impressed by Egesta's wealth. And on its return, the ambassadors reported very favourably to the assembly. They said in no uncertain terms that Egesta seemed extremely wealthy and there would be no problem whatsoever in funding Athenian help to the place. What this embassy didn't know was that it had been duped. The people of Egesta had collected together all of their valuable objects and they filled a house with them. The Athenians went into that house. They saw how apparently wealthy the household was. But as they left the house, the Egestians quickly took the same objects and put them in the next house. And so on and so forth. So that every house the Athenians visited gave this impression that everyone living in Egesta must be loaded. Now, clearly, the Athenians weren't very observant if they kept seeing the same things over and over again and it didn't click. In Athens, an assembly was held about whether to help Egesta. Now, as I said, this would mean taking on Syracuse as well, and the Athenians were aware of this. Alcibiades and Nicias were both strategoi in that year. And Thucydides gives us what he says is their speeches. Now remember, Thucydides was exiled in 424. We're now in 416. So Thucydides is very much relying on hearsay when he gives us their speeches. But remember also, I've said that he's not averse to manipulating what the speakers said to make a point. Nicias spoke against supporting Egesta on the very real grounds that Athenian involvement would be costly, that the Athenians would have to split their forces, and that this wasn't very clever as they were still at war with Sparta. Moreover, Nicias said, even if Athens was successful in Sicily, it was so far away and it would add so little to the Athenians' empire that they'd need to keep a permanent force on the island to ensure its loyalty. And that's true. Nicias also attacked Alcibiades for his youth and his motives in wanting Athens to commit to the expedition in the first place. he said to the Athenians that Alcibiades was only after his own personal glory. Then Alcibiades gave a speech in which he rebutted many of Nicias' personal comments, such as his ostentatious display of his wealth. And Alcibiades exhorted the people to vote for the expedition. His rhetoric was effective, and it caused Nicias to give another speech in which he tried to use scare tactic rhetoric on the people by saying how much they would end up having to spend from their own pockets after all, and the potential losses to manpower that an expedition to Sicily would bring. In fact, it's Nicias who gives us a context for when Athens recovered from the plague, because in one of his speeches at this assembly debate, Nicias says, it's only now that we've recovered from the plague. So that's why there's this about 15 years or so for the Athenians to recoup manpower losses from the plague of 429. What Nicias said was to no avail. The crowd at the assembly, carried away by Alcibiades' oratorical prowess, voted to send not 60 triremes that Alcibiades had asked for, but 100 triremes. Command of this expedition was split among three commanders, Alcibiades, Lamachus, and Nicias. Now, Nicias's inclusion is surprising, since he was against the venture from the outset. But perhaps he was made a commander as a check on the younger and more rash or impetuous Alcibiades. Now, the speeches of Nicias and Alcibiades that Thucydides gives us cannot be verbatim, as I said. Thucydides was exiled from Athens in 424. For the rest of the war, by the way, he travelled the Greek world collecting notes for his account of it. What's more, this debate, the Sicilian debate, is unique in Thucydides' history because he gives us three speeches from it. He doesn't give us his usual pair, i.e. one person speaking for something, another person speaking against it, as say with the Mytilene debate, Cleon versus Diodotus. In the Sicilian debate, we have a speech against the expedition by Nicias. We have one in favour of it by Alcibiades. And then we have another one by Nicias, also against the expedition. Again, no one, as far as I know, has really gone into this. Why Thucydides gives us three speeches? But what I do know is that Thucydides doesn't do this sort of thing without a reason. I think Thucydides wants to build up for us just how disastrous the people's decision will be, because the people voted to send this large fleet to Sicily. And Thucydides wants us to focus on Nicias's caution, which, with the benefit of hindsight, was justified this time. Thucydides gives us two speeches from Nicias, and in effect, he's giving the people two chances not to go to Sicily. But even when hit with two speeches from Nicias, who makes extremely good points in them, the mass of the people in the assembly are still carried away by Alcibiades' performance. So once again, Thucydides' contempt for how the people handled their political power and his highlighting of the flaw of direct democracy shine through. Another heresy, by the way. Now, the armada to Sicily was ready to set sail in 415. But on the morning of its departure, two blasphemous acts were discovered that compromised it. First, the Athenians woke up to find that the Hermes had been mutilated. Now, Hermes are square stone pillars, on top of which sat a bust, a head of the god Hermes. And these Hermes also had male genitalia on the front of the pillar. Now, Hermes were like good luck symbols. They were placed in front of houses and temples, at crossroads and along roadsides to protect travellers, because Hermes was the god of travel. It's a bit like Catholics today who have St. Christopher medals in their cars or on their persons to protect them as they go about their travels. Now, since the head of Hermes was on each pillar, the Hermes were sacrosanct. That meant that however they were mutilated, perhaps some facial features were lopped off and parts of the genitalia, we won't go there, it meant that this mutilation was a sacrilegious act. However, given Hermes' attributes, god of travel, the vandalism was also seen as a bad omen for the Sicilian expedition, and the fleet was immediately put on hold. Again then, we see that religion goes hand in hand with Greek daily life. It always will. Second, this is the second thing that happened. Obviously, the profanation of the mysteries. This was a religious cult that took place at Eleusis, to the west of Athens. Everything to do with it was secret, and only those who were initiated in the cult knew what went on at meetings, hence the name Mysteries. It had the air of mystery, as, say, the Masons do today, for example. Now, whether an outsider infiltrated a meeting of the initiates, thereby compromising this secret sect, or whether someone parodied what the initiates were supposed to do when they got together, is not exactly known. But needless to say, given the religious significance, the god would have been offended. Indeed, anyone who violated these secret cults was open to prosecution. There's an example of Aristophanes, who parodied some of the rites in this cult quite inadvertently in one of his plays and was brought up on charges for this. Today, we think of the humour and the made-up intrigues that are acceptable about many secret societies. Think of Monty Python's Spot the Mason sketch, or of course the Da Vinci Code and its sinister portrayal of the Knights Templar and Opus Dei. But there was no similar toleration in ancient Greece. Although there was no evidence against him, Alcibiades' enemies blamed him and his youthful gang of friends for the mutilation of the Hermes and the profanation of the mysteries. The Athenians viewed impiety very seriously, as I said. This is still an age when traditional orthodoxy prevailed. And the people believed that it was essential for the well-being of the state to remain in the god's favour. And so Alcibiades faced a severe penalty, even death, if he was found guilty. He immediately demanded to be tried, but an assembly debated the matter, and that assembly could not find any evidence against him. So it was decided to let him sail with the fleet. So after all of these shenanigans, the great fleet set sail. After it picked up more ships and men from allies as it sailed to a stopping off point at Corcyra, the armada, as it sailed across the Mediterranean, consisted of 134 triremes and around 25,000 soldiers. And these were supported by 130 ships carrying supplies. Now this is an enormous force. It's enough to take on half a dozen Sicilies. It crossed the Mediterranean and it put in at Rhegium in southern Italy, only a stone's throw from Sicily. And there it was discovered that the Egestans had lied about their wealth, that they were unable, after all, to pay for the cost of the expedition. Now, this was a massive blow because, as Thucydides says, this fleet was the most expensive ever put together. To make matters worse, the three commanders couldn't agree on a plan of action for some time. Nicias advised going to the aid of a jester against Silenus in keeping with the original intent of the mission, and then going home. Alcibiades wanted to try to win over as many Sicilian cities as possible, with a view to taking on Syracuse. Lamachus, on the other hand, was in favour of attacking Syracuse now, before the Syracusans could properly deploy their own considerable fleet. Now, Lamachus is very much the junior member of this trio. He seems to have been disregarded all the time. And so when nobody listened to him, he threw in his support to Alcibiades. But it's about this time that Alcibiades was recalled to Athens to stand trial for his alleged role in the mutilation of the Hermes and the profanation of the mysteries. Clearly, his enemies had found it easier to disparage him when he'd left Athens. Now, after his enforced departure for Athens, Nicias and Lamachus continued to disagree about what to do. The end result was that the Athenian fleet did nothing for the rest of 415 and very little for 414. However, in that year, 414, the idea was obviously formed to besiege Syracuse. And to this end, the Athenians began to build a wall to the west of Syracuse on a plain called Epipolae, the idea being to use this as a defensive wall for their army to besiege Syracuse, while at the same time their fleet would blockade it from Syracuse's harbour. That's perhaps why in 414 we have an embassy from Syracuse going to Sparta asking for help against the Athenians. And guess who also lent their voices to the Syracusan request? Corinth. Because Syracuse was a Corinthian colony, remember? So what had started off as a separate undertaking from the Peloponnesian War to help Egesta and potentially conquer Sicily, and so add it to the Athenian Empire, had now blown up in the Athenians' faces. The costliest expedition ever was now part of the Peloponnesian War anyway. And to make matters worse, the Syracusans didn't take too kindly to the Athenians building that wall to the west of Syracuse, and they launched an attack on the Athenians, and during this attack, Lamachus was killed. That meant that supreme command was now in the hands of Nicias, the man who'd been against the expedition in the first place, and he'd hardly performed brilliantly elsewhere anyway. Remember his lackluster effort at Sphacteria. I wonder whether any Athenian remembered the second of Pericles' strategies not to expand the empire until the war was over, and wished that the clock could be turned back. The recall of Alcibiades, in fact the recall of any general, at such a critical juncture in this Sicilian campaign, was not only disgraceful on the part of the Athenians, given that the assembly had found there was no evidence against him previously, but also it was stupid. It's another example of the mass of the people being swayed by the rhetoric of speakers, in this case, Alcibiades' enemies. Pericles was obviously just a name by now, and his strategy had long been disregarded. Needless to say, Alcibiades saw the writing on the wall. In other words, he knew that he was going to fall victim to trumped-up charges in a trial, especially as most of his support base was now in the western Mediterranean with the fleet. So Alcibiades took the only course open to him. He escaped from his escort back to Athens and fled to Sparta, no less, where he began to intrigue with the Spartans against the Athenians. They'd treated him so contemptuously anyway, so can we really blame him for that? But back to Sicily. We've got Lamachus now dead, we've got Nicias in sole command. For once, Nicias took the bull by the horns and he ordered the fleet into the harbour at Syracuse. Now, this bold move took the Syracusans a bit by surprise, and it would have lessened the odds on the Athenians quite a bit as well. But then the tables turned dramatically for Syracuse, and the odds on the Athenians went sky high again. The Syracusan embassy to Sparta had met with success after all. It was aided in its quest by Corinth's diplomacy and also by Alcibiades, who was still in Sparta. And the Spartans now make an alliance with Syracuse, and they sent a general by the name of Gylippus and a force to Syracuse. And within days of arriving at Syracuse, Dilippus and the Spartans had formed a joint plan with the Syracusans that undid all of Nicias' good work. They attacked the Athenian forces at Epipolae, and they built a counter wall to what the Athenians were still trying to construct. That meant the blockade of Syracuse from the west was now impossible. Gylippus, by the way, is an interesting character. He's a product of the declining number of Spartiates. Let me explain. As we know, in Sparta, only those that had graduated in the agoge and could maintain their syssity on Jews were homoioi, or equals, Spartiates. Anyone else was an inferior. But manpower problems meant that the Spartans had to rethink some things. And one was whether they needed to make adjustments to their society. And we find the rise of a group of Spartans at this time called Mothakes. These are either Spartans who could no longer maintain their syssity on Jews, or, this is interesting, they were the children of Spartan fathers and Helot mothers. And Gylippus was a Mothax. And here he is, not a lowly soldier pressed into service, but the general in charge of the Spartan army in Syracuse. Nicias now sent a letter to the Athenian assembly requesting that he be relieved of his command. He had some kidney disease, so this is perhaps fair dinkum. But he also said in that same letter that Sicily was a lost cause, and that if the Athenians wanted to take the place, they'd need to send out another force as big as the first one. Well, he was probably not exaggerating here, and he probably thought that his language would make the Athenians see sense, that they'd realize the time had come to cut their losses. That's a prudent thing to do. But once again, the assembly didn't see sense. They didn't recall Nicias, and swayed by the oratory of speakers in Athens, the Athenians voted a second expedition, this one under the command of Demosthenes. Now, this second fleet arrived in 413, and it hit trouble immediately. While trying to take Epipolae, Demosthenes was soundly defeated, and he immediately decided that the time was more than ripe to get the heck out of there. Now, this would have been music to Nicias' ears, especially as Gylippus the Spartan was increasing his own force daily with reinforcements from elsewhere in Sicily and also the Peloponnesian League. Then nature intervened. As the Athenian force was getting ready to set sail, a lunar eclipse occurred. Now, Thucydides says the Athenians interpreted this eclipse as a sign that they were to stay. And they were to stay for 27 days. Thucydides talks about 3 times 9 days. Nicias, who was very superstitious and believed in omens, announced that he was going to follow the advice of those who had interpreted the eclipse as meaning they should stay for another 27 days. And so, as a result, the Athenian fleet stayed where it was in the harbour at Syracuse. Now, this was the chance the Syracusans had been waiting for. They blocked up the entrance to their harbour so the Athenian fleet couldn't put to sea even if it wanted to. And then the Syracusans attacked the Athenians and their allies with all they had. In a series of engagements in the great harbour at Syracuse, the Athenians and their allies were completely defeated. Those who survived the battle, about 40,000 of them, including Demosthenes and Nicias, by the way, swam for safety from their sinking vessels. But the only place they could swim to, of course, was the shores of Sicily. In effect, given the power of Syracuse in Sicily, not to mention the presence of the Spartan army there, the Athenians were fleeing through enemy territory, and they were hunted down. The slaughter was terrible. Thousands of them, including Demosthenes, were killed at the hands of the Syracusans and the Peloponnesians. These people relentlessly pursued them. They fired arrows at them. They speared them as they ran away. At one river crossing, the river Asinarus, so many Athenians were massacred that the water ran red with blood. Thucydides says that it was at this river that the greatest number of men in the entire war died in one spot. This was the point where Nicias surrendered to Gylippus, offering his own life if Gylippus would order the massacre to end. Gylippus agreed, and the remaining Athenians were then taken captive. The Sicilian expedition was over. How would the horrific news be received in Athens? What's going to happen next? Well, we'll answer these questions in our next lecture, which will also deal with a period of oligarchy in Athens, an oligarchy that arose because of the failure of the direct democracy over Sicily. Thank you very much.